And welcome to Against the Law, the ancient history podcast that aims to separate fact from fiction in the ancient world. Today, the podcast team are pitching to me their favourite classical story retellings. Their aim is to persuade me to pick their favourite or most interesting retold stories. What's a retelling? Well, it's a classical story retold in the modern day. Maybe it's from a new perspective, focuses on specific ancient characters, or elaborates on parts of the tale that deserve to be known. As usual, we have Xenia, whose main focus is, and always will be, ancient Rome. We have Meg, whose area of expertise is ancient Greece. And we've got Barney, who knows all about the ancient Near East. I'm Flo, and I'm not an expert in the ancient world at all, but I love a good story. So let's hear the team's pitches today, dear listener, on ancient retellings. So yes, indeed, today we are focusing on the retelling of ancient stories. And I think, Meg, you've got a better definition than I can provide. So what are we going to be talking about specifically today?
That's a good question. And I think with this series, we've already done some defining in our mini episode. And I do think it's quite difficult to define these things because the nature of reception, as we were talking about last episode, means it's very like audience driven, if that makes sense. So if we did a reception of the ancient world, that would be defined by what we think about the ancient world and also what we think about the modern world. So it's very kind of user oriented. I don't know if that's a useful word, but people in my work in IT say that all the time. I would say reception is a kind of user oriented term. And I think the retellings are how I would define them is basically stories, normally novels, written in the present day. There's been a massive boom of them in the last, say, sort of 10 years, where people have taken the life of someone from ancient literature or the ancient world and sort of shone a light on it or a magnifying glass and said there's more to be had here, there's more story to be had here, and retold it in a way that makes it sort of different or relevant for the modern day. And I think a really key element of retellings is that they often take someone whose story or whose voice has been seen to be lacking in the ancient stories themselves. So a classic example would be Madeline Miller's Circe, where she sort of tells the story of Circe's encounter with Odysseus, which we get for the first time in the Odyssey, but very much from kind of Odysseus and his men's perspective, and she tells it from Circe's perspective. So I think that's a classic example of a retelling.
Groovy. So Meg, since you've helped us define and shape a little bit what we're talking about, could you elevator pitch me a good retelling that you've got as an example, and I will let you know whether or not I want to read it?
Yes, absolutely. So this is a bit of a, I don't know, I don't want to say I've discovered a really good book that no one else has heard of, because you always sound like a bit of a fool when you say that. But this is a book from 2001, so I would say it's in a sort of earlier stream of ancient retellings. It maybe be this and Margaret Atwood's Penelopiad, or Penelopiad, which is obviously the story of Penelope. But this is a book called Achilles by Elizabeth Cook, as I say, from 2001, so well before the big kind of recent boom of retellings. And it is just so good. I'm not going to tell you what happens, but I am going to tell you that there is a huge twist in the last chapter, like a really, really big, the kind of twist that you really, really are not expecting from a book like this. It's about the life of Achilles, and it tells his story in this really sort of beautiful, lyrical way. It's quite a short book, has been called a prose poem, I think, in some reviews. So sort of using very poetic language, tells the story of Achilles, really makes you kind of feel his anguish about the decision that he has to make, and makes you feel his love for his family, for his sort of comrades in battle, for Patroclus. And then there's a big twist at the end, and you can't say fairer than that. So I'd really, really recommend it. It's very short.
Is the twist that Achilles was in space all along?
Oh my goodness.
That would be so good. So you mean the whole thing is happening, maybe some kind of like simulation on space, and he just wakes up in a spaceship?
Yeah. I don't know if any of you have watched the seminal BBC time travel police drama, Life on Mars.
Yeah, of course. I love it.
John Sim can
get it.
Take me out to dinner any day.
Oh yeah, all that.
One of the greatest series of all time, arguably. But when it was adapted for the US market, they obviously had to literalize the title in an incredibly extreme way, and the big twist was that Sam Tyler and Gene Hunt were, in fact, astronauts on a mission to Mars.
immediately exit the podcast.
That is astonishing.
What?
But that it already has a big twist, right? In like Ashes to Ashes. Do you know the twist? That it's revealed that
shh, don't tell anyone.
Okay. I mean, I think it came out like a good 15 years ago, but
that is generally a twist that I still don't tell people though.
Okay, all right, fine. I won't say it.
But yeah, no, and in the American one, also Gene Hunt is Sam Tyler's dad. So, I mean, yeah. They really dropped the ball.
No, I think they're in love, if anything.
Oh, no. Do you?
Achilles and Patroclus.
Exactly.
Okay, right. Well, so Life on Mars remains spoilerless today, but you should definitely check that out. If any of us are doing suggestions, that's mine. Okay, so there's a sort of like M. Night Shyamalan twist at the end of your favourite retelling of Achilles. That's kind of got me intrigued. I think I'm strongly considering it. I'll weigh up my decision about my favourite suggestion at the end of the podcast. So Xenia, have you brought us your favourite retelling today?
So I tended to read lots of Greek retellings when I was younger, and I haven't read that many since. Meg mentioned Circe earlier. I did read that. I kind of enjoyed it. It's very like intensively full of Greek mythological references. And I think if you're, I don't know, when I was reading it, like obviously as a classicist, I got them. But I did wonder whether non-classicists, I mean, it's a great story anyway, but I think sometimes, I think it's aimed at more of like a classicist audience, because non-classicists may not sort of get the richness of the classical references within there. So I was a little bit worried about that from a kind of retellings perspective, from like an accessibility perspective. And I have to say, one of my friends who did read it, she was like, yeah, I didn't get half of it. So that was interesting. The other one I've read is Natalie Haynes, who's a comedian. She does Natalie Haynes Stands Up for the Classics. It's like a Radio 4 series where she kind of talks about figures from ancient history or ancient texts, like and makes them funny. It's really good, actually. I would strongly recommend Natalie Haynes Stands Up for the Classics. But she's also written quite a few retellings. The one of hers that I've read is called The Children of Jocasta, which is like a retelling of the Oedipus story, but from the perspective of Jocasta. So Oedipus's mum and wife and the mother of his children. Should I recap the Oedipus story quite quickly?
The fact that his mum is also his wife and the mother of his children is pretty much like, that's the headline, I'd say.
Okay. I've given away the twist there, but yeah, basically. And she tries to explore it from kind of the perspective of Jocasta. You know, what was it like having to give away her baby who turns out to be Oedipus? What was it like then, you know? What was her life like with him as her husband? What was it like when she kind of finds out what's really happened and the state that her family's in? And it was really nice. It was a good sort of different perspective to have. I think for me, it took away a little bit from like the stomach churning horror of the original Greek tragedy, where you just kind of go, oh my goodness, what is this? Is so violent, this is so horrible, this is like, I can't even get my head around it, what is happening? Whereas the kind of gentle and sympathetic way that Natalie retold the story, it, as I say, it was very nice, but I think for me, the point of the Oedipus story is like, oh, whoa, this is insane. And it didn't have that for me.
Got it. So you crave violence and gore. And it wasn't delivered on this occasion.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting, though. Do you think, Xenia, that like there is a lack of sympathy in the original? Would we say that that's true of ancient literature?
Oh, that, you know what? That's a lovely, yeah, that's a lovely thought. Well, no, not lovely, but really interesting. I think that there's more sympathy in Euripides. So he's like the third of the great Greek tragedians, and he's famous for kind of making his main characters not really high-ranking people, and introducing different perspectives, but within the sort of Greek play formula of like three main characters and a chorus and everything, everyone like dies or is miserable at the end. I find there's more sympathy in his characters. But yeah, I think in the kind of traditional model of Greek tragedy, it's because it's all about, like, it's almost like a warning, isn't it? A lot of them are about hubris and, like, don't mess with the gods, because this is the most awful thing that can happen to you. It's that idea of catharsis, isn't it? That, like, you watch something horrible happen to someone else and you kind of go, oh, my life's not so bad after all, is it?
Yeah, so that's by definition not going to be sympathetic. We're not meant to sort of feel, or I guess not empathetic as well. We shouldn't feel what's happening to them. We should be, as you say, feel sort of distance from them.
But I always find it, when Euripides writes, I find it really difficult not to empathise with his characters, even like the people who do, the characters that do the worst possible things. So I got really into Medea when I was about 14, and I just
classic 14-year-old girl activity is to get really into Medea.
And I genuinely spent one summer holiday, you know, the school summer holidays that are just really, really long, and I spent a good week like sort of rewriting or abridging Euripides' Medea, and we actually performed it in my classics club at school. But with that text, like, even though she, here's the twist, sorry guys, spoiler alert, even though she murders her children, you kind of go into this zone with her and you go, I'm feeling this horror, I'm feeling this injustice. And she's incredibly persuasive as a character, and you suddenly go, yeah, I can see why you did that, even though it is the worst possible thing you can do.
So what I'm getting from this, Senya, is that you crave violence and shun literature that goes too softly, and you also feel sorry for child killers.
This episode is not going in my favour, is it?
We could ask what Xenia's position on Medea's dragons is, maybe as a lifeline.
That was difficult to stage, that bit, not going to lie.
That's just one of the craziest bits about it to me, is that, like, most of the narrative is, like, very naturalistic. And then just at the end, it's just like, yeah, dragon time.
I've just looked it up, guys, and there is a brand new spellbinding and gripping mythical retelling of Medea coming out this year. So we could all read that and report back.
Is there dragons?
I was literally just about to say, if they get rid of the dragons, I literally don't know what the point is. Like,
also, not going to lie, it's easy to sell, you know, content on the basis of dragons these days in a post sort of Game of Thrones world, right? So they'd be leaving money on the table there.
You sound so bitter about that. You're like, these days, kids just don't appreciate it. It's so easy to sell content on the value of dragons.
You're being dismissive of How to Train Your Dragon and a dragon that came before them, you know?
So true, Flo.
Hipsters with your Game of Thrones.
I wish in our reception series that we could get on to how to Tame Your Dragon as some sort of Old Norse reception, maybe, because that is an incredible series of books and films.
There is a live-action film coming out.
A live-action film? Is Chris Pratt playing Toothless?
No, thank goodness. They've got Nick Frost is in it. I know that much. I think Gerard Butler, maybe, is in it.
He's in the original?
Yep. Should be, at the very least, very interesting. I'm excited to watch it. I'm watching it with my kid at the moment, the animated series. Okay, all right. So I've got a M. Night Shyamalan twist from Meg. I've got a dark but empathetic view from Xenia. Barney, I'm going to move on to you next. What have you got to pitch to me as a good retelling?
So the popular train in publishing trends of these retellings has not quite pulled into the ancient Near East station just yet. Whilst there are a few retellings of certain myths from the ancient Near East, they're not sort of hitting the bestseller status like some of the ones that we've mentioned so far have been. So noteworthily, there's going to be a series, a trilogy, I think, by a journalist and author called Emily H. Wilson, who is retelling myths from the ancient Near East that sort of intersect a little bit with Gilgamesh, but they're from the perspective of the female deity Inanna, who is Ishtar. So she is telling large parts of the main mythic cycle from the ancient Near East, from, let's say, Babylonia, through the lens of this female goddess, because Inanna, as Ishtar, appears in the Epic of Gilgamesh, for example, but she also appears in many other poems and myths, including Ishtar's descent into the underworld, which is a discussion of her trip down.
Her trip down.
It's a jaunt, a jolly.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I've not read Inanna, So I can't really talk very much about that, although I had a look at some of the pages and I think, yeah, it's a fairly colloquial tone. It's got the emphasis on maybe a voice that is a smaller character in the Epic of Gilgamesh, this goddess, and she is sort of put front and center. So I think it's a similar trend to what Meg was describing earlier of giving voice to, you know, identities that are slightly less represented in the original tellings. So I've actually going to have to bring, Flo, to you today, a Greek retelling as well.
My goodness. Okay.
I know, Barney's gone Greek. Because, yes, I've got a Gilgamesh retelling called Gilgamesh Retold, but it's essentially an adapted translation of the narrative. And whilst the focus is, according to the blurb, supposed to be returning Gilgamesh to its earlier oral roots, where men and women were more equal, that the reigning deity of Gilgamesh's city was female, this is Inanna again, and that women had their own language, which is an interesting point that we've not really discussed in the past. Actually, going through this Jenny Lewis retelling of Gilgamesh is essentially just the poem redone. So, for all those reasons, I'm bringing to the table Colm Tobin's House of Names, which is a 2018 retelling of the Oresteia, which is the play, a series of plays, Greek plays, about the killing of Agamemnon and the cursing of the house of Atreus through the revenge that sort of spirals out of control. So Agamemnon is killed by his wife, Clytemnestra. Sorry, spoiler alert. And Clytemnestra is eventually killed by her son, Orestes, after a period of being away. And I actually, despite pitching this book to you, Flo, I don't really like it.
Oh, so bold move.
Yeah, I think it's good to have a bit of difference in the chat today, you know?
An anti-pitch,
exactly. A warding off. But I think we can look at how these retellings work through sort of negative examples as well as positive ones. What I don't really like about House of Names is that despite the fact that the author gave interviews at the time about the fact that he was trying to give voice to a lot of the women in this cycle in a way that the plays didn't necessarily, because in his own words, that they were being told what to do by stage directions and stuff like that. He spends, I would say, well over half of the book with Orestes when he's away from his city, and not as much time with Clytemnestra and Electra.
Dang.
Who is the sister or the daughter. So despite the fact that he ostensibly was trying to give voice to women, he really does spend a shed load of time speculating on what Orestes was up to when he was away. It's just quite boring. He's not particularly concerned with any of the sort of the mythological or classical references in it. I think that's probably a strength. It's not really bogged down in the kind of, you know, what was going on in the Trojan War and who everybody is to everyone else and who's, you know, because these people are inevitably semi-divine and related to deities in some way. He's not particularly interested in that. But the prose is just very dry. I think the idea was to focus on the sort of the human drama rather than you know, any of the sort of the web of mythic references and stuff like that. But it's just quite slow and quite boring, and I can't really recommend it.
It's funny as well, because I get that, like, Clytemnestra doesn't really have, she's more of like a one-dimensional character, but Electra and the one who never gets talked about, who I played once, Chrysothemis, her sister, like, they genuinely do have like quite good roles within the Greek play, the original Greek play. So I'm confused by the fact that he wanted to give extra voice to these women who arguably do have fairly strong voices in the ancient version.
I think actually that the Electra perspective, the book follows three perspectives, and, you know, the sections are named Clytemnestra, Orestes and Electra, and there are multiple for Orestes, predictably. the Electra section is certainly the weakest.
Yeah. And also, I would love to hear the story retold from Orestes' best friend's perspective, because he must be like, what is going on? What have I got myself into? This is mental.
This family is so weird.
Like an inverse Saltburn.
Yes.
Yeah. There's murder on the bathtub.
I don't bring up bathtubs after I've seen Saltburn, okay? I'm scarred. Oh my god.
Literally, no, there's so many weirder things in the canon of Greek tragedy than happened in the entirety of Saltburn. Like
that, Meg, that sounds like such a blurb for our podcast.
Yeah.
Hey kids, enjoyed Saltburn?
Are you ready for more depraved activity? Oh, the only thing I was going to say is, like, those stories have also been retold by both later Greek tragedians. I can never say that word. Tragedians. But the Oresteia is originally by Aeschylus, who was the earliest of the Greek tragedians. I'm actually going to stop saying it, tragic playwrights. And then both of the later ones, Sophocles and Euripides, wrote their own plays about those characters. So that's a really interesting example of a text that has already been told within, you know, say a 60-year period or 100-year period or whatever in the ancient world, with different perspectives given to those different characters.
Yeah, and then the Romans got involved as well, and Seneca did his versions.
Oh, he loved a little retelling, didn't he? Seneca's Thyestes is a classic.
So would you like to hear what some of the praise from the reviews that's included on the first page of the House of Names says about it? You will not be surprised to hear that the Financial Times says that this book has considerable Game of Thrones appeal.
Oh, see, that I am cynical about.
But it's so reductive, like, in the sense that Game of Thrones is a book with, like, first-person narrative perspectives. That's literally about all it's got in common. Well, actually, a nicer reference, maybe, that the Oresteia has to other literature is, I think, being the inspiration for the tragedy of the main family in the Dune novels.
Yes, I was gonna bring that up as well, although in the film context, like the House of the Atreides.
Atreides. Paul Atreides. Yeah.
The worst fantasy name ever, Paul.
Paul. It's better than the other guy. What's he called? Duncan. Isn't there a Duncan?
Duncan Idaho.
Duncan Idaho. It's crazy.
Duncan Idaho is such a porn name.
It's like, there's that TikTok, isn't there, where it's like me reading fantasy. It's like, and then went to with Carl.
But yeah, no, so the House of Atreides, in Dune, I think is named for the House of Atreus in the Greek myths, which is a nice little reference there. Although there's not so much mother killing. There's quite a lot of, mother and father killing. There is quite a lot of death and tragedy that besets their house. So I think probably a little link there.
Yeah, absolutely. Atreides is the patronymic, isn't it? So the House of Atreides, they are the Atreides. They are the sons and descendants of Atreus.
Ah, nice.
If I could briefly just butt in to say, if you're going to watch Dune, the original, it's very long and very confusing, and I was just shocked. Sting turns up at one point. That was surprising.
I'm an Englishman in Arrakis.
Yeah. It's just...
Let's not just skip over that.
I think that's a good joke.
Great. It's brilliant. Exactly. Let's not skip over it. Just thinking about what you were saying, Xenia, about, like, in the Oresteia example, like, are those voices silent? And this, I think, is such an interesting thing about these retellings, that they've really kind of sold themselves on the premise of a marginalised or silenced group, the vast majority of which we're talking about women. And I just kind of want to, like, pick at that premise. I'm just not sure it's true. I think women have, like, in tragedy especially, they're all over the place. Like, there's loads of women, and we do get to hear directly from them. And I basically just not sure that the premise is valid, that women have been silenced.
Yeah. Are we projecting our patriarchy onto the ancient world? Well, I guess, I mean, it was even more patriarchal, but that doesn't mean we don't, like, women don't have strong voices protesting against the patriarchy, even in ancient tech.
Exactly. I think, obviously, the ancient world, you know, ancient Greece, for example, was a very patriarchal society, and women did not have a particularly active role in public life. But I would say they had a really active role in the stories. There are so few stories in the ancient world about just men, whereas there are loads of stories in the modern world about just men.
What about stories about sponges? I have it on really good authority that the SpongeBob SquarePants movie is based on Homer's Odyssey.
Is it?
Oh my God.
So SpongeBob, SpongeBob is on a heroic quest and described as an incredibly dangerous heroic odyssey. There is a cyclops in the movie, and Mindy gifts SpongeBob and Patrick a bag of winds.
I mean, that's compelling, for sure.
But wait for it. I found another weirder one. Moulin Rouge. Actually, it's not weirder. It's definitely more palatable. Moulin Rouge is based on Orpheus and Eurydice.
Yeah, nice.
In the underworld.
Wow. I didn't know any of those. This is really cool.
And the SpongeBob one has me reeling. I also found out this week that the creator of SpongeBob has canonically now said that SpongeBob is autistic, and I hate that because I hate SpongeBob SquarePants. Just going to put it out there. I find it really overwhelming. Just to clarify for any listeners who might not know, I'm autistic, so I don't want to share a diagnosis with SpongeBob, but here we are.
That is rough. Sharing a diagnosis with your most hated character.
With a very loud, irritating sponge. Oh no, I'm loud and irritating. Oh dear.
Have you heard the translated names of SpongeBob into other European languages?
No, Barney. What translations of SpongeBob have we got?
I think in French he's Bob l'Éponge.
Oh nice.
Bob l'Éponge. That sounds like a character in June.
Duncan Idaho and Bob l'Éponge.
His best friend Bob l'Éponge.
I wonder what square is, because he'd be Bob l'Éponge avec le pantalon de square.
I think in Spanish he's Bob Esponja.
Oh, that's
nice.
That's kind of sexy.
Yeah.
Ew, sexy.
Just the name, not the sponge.
No, I was about to say exactly that. I was like, yeah.
I'm going to have to do the washing up after this episode, and I really don't want to look at my sponge in a different way. Sexy, Bobby, Éponge, or whatever his name is.
Do you not have a scrub daddy?
No. Like,
oh my God.
Patriarchy much. Hot. I've got a scrub mummy.
Scrub daddy is not hot.
The scrub daddy, what that mouth do?
Actually... I think you'll find out that the scrub daddy, when he is made hot, is more pliable and bendable. So,
well,
yeah, that's one of the major. But... It's one of the major marketing points of the scrub daddy. I think if you understand your scrub daddy lore, Meg.
I think that that scrub daddy is a retelling of the Egyptian opening of the mouth ritual.
Have we maybe taken retellings too far in this episode?
I would say that the publishing industry started it, Flo, and we're just finishing it.
Fair enough. Okay, fair enough. If I can put a stop to all this sponge chat, Xenia, a little birdie told me that we might have some retellings that started a little closer to home.
Yeah, so after my sort of age 14 deep dive into the story of Medea, I started thinking about other ways of doing retellings or adaptations, and I did have an idea actually for a TV series based on Zeus's infidelity. It actually kind of reads in quite bad taste now, because you know a lot of Zeus's behavior is actually extremely violent, and so to kind of sanitize it in like a very sort of, I don't know, 1980s, oh look at this hilarious affair, is probably not really for today's audience. But anyway, I have fun coming up with it. At the time, the idea is that Zeus runs a packaging and delivery company.
Nice.
So that's,
has he got Hermes as an employee?
Exactly, that's how Hermes is involved. Like Hermes is sort of the fast track courier DHL type thing. And Hera is constantly like popping up into the office unannounced, trying to catch him out. There was one where he, you know, so there's one story of Zeus's infidelity where he tries to have sex basically with a woman called Io. And Hera like sort of catches him, and so he turns her into a cow. So I had this idea where like he's getting it on with Io and in the bubble wrap cupboard, and then just like bubble wraps her into a statue.
Nice. That's a kink in some circles.
Yeah, I was younger. I didn't think this one through very well. That's
so funny.
Anyway, more similar episodes were in the plan, which I actually don't even have anymore. So there we go. That's all the world is getting of Zeus behaving badly.
That's a shame, because I think, you know, if you maybe perhaps a little more sensitively approach some of the plot lines, I think that would be quite a good good story. You could do dark comedy.
So if you've got sort of Hermes and DHL and stuff in there, who is Fujitsu's Horizon Technology? And does the British Post Office scandal feature in your Zeus Behaving Badly packaging, postage, delivery sort of extended metaphor?
What a way to tell the Post Office scandal is through the medium of Zeus Behaving Badly.
Well, you never know, Meg. In another millennia, it might all merge into, you know, that might be a retelling that is there.
Mm,
you can, might be. I can imagine it, you know, being mutated through the eons of time. Eons of time? Is that a thing?
When the Post Office Scandal ITV show came out at the start of the year, I saw Toby Jones walking around the street near me. And like, I think if I saw Toby Jones at any other time in my life, I would not have been excited.
How dare you? We love Toby Jones in this house. We saw the Indiana Jones latest film and we went, oh, is that Toby Jones?
Toby is Jones. That Dobby?
How dare you? How dare you diminish Toby Jones to Dobby?
He is Dobby.
I know he is Dobby, but he's so much more.
That's a really weird shout out in this episode. Scrub Daddy, yeah. Toby Jones, John Sim.
Friend of the podcast, Toby Friend Jones.
Well, Toby, if you're listening, our household, who runs the number one Toby Jones fan club in the UK, not in the world though, because there's a bigger one in Austria. We love you, and we would have been excited to see you, even if Barney wasn't. All right, has anybody else penned any retellings in this podcast? Come on, spill the beans.
So yeah, guilty. The beans are spilled. One of my sort of abandoned COVID projects was to attempt a retelling of Egyptian myth in the style of Stephen Fry's Mythos or Neil Gaiman's Norse mythology book, and it was really difficult. I think you know, Neil Gaiman had basically the body of Norse myth called the Edda to draw on, so he was able basically just to take that as his sort of source text and then retell that chapter by chapter or poem by poem. And you know, I think maybe Meg or Xenia can correct me, but Stephen Fry has been able to use texts like the Metamorphoses, for example, Ovid's Metamorphoses, as the basis, as you know, a series of little myths to retell. I mean, I think he's got another book which is called Gods and Heroes or something like that, as well as Mythos, which I assume is adapted from multiple sources. But what I found very difficult about the Egyptian side of things is that there is, you know, there's no sort of single canon, there's no collected text, so you'd be having to go through thousands of years worth of poems and poetry and different regional myths and trying to harmonize them in a way that, you know, that people of ancient Egypt never really did themselves. And yeah, I found it incredibly difficult. I spent a lot of time trying to do the creation of the world and spent a lot of time on the sun god Ra, and I found it quite tough. I think one of the aims of those sort of mythic retellings is to kind of, I guess, bring these things to new audiences and maybe update the tone of the original. You know, I think especially with Stephen Fry, it's supposed to be quite sort of colloquial and casual. And I was struggling to strike that balance with the Egyptian side of things. Maybe thinking too much about how a lot of this religion would have been restricted to priestly context and an individual person's understanding of it might have been limited to their own sort of personal household domestic religion. And yeah, I don't know. I struggled to capture the spirit of the poems that I was reading and trying to retell.
I think you should endeavour to carry on, Barney, because I think if there's a lack of ancient Near Eastern retelling literature, I think that there's a gap in the market for you. It's a Barney-shaped hole, but you can go too far with it, though. I swear I've seen Shakespeare and like the Bible retold for teenagers, and it's like Mark said to Jesus, "Yo, what you up to, fam? No cap." So don't go too crazy.
I mean, I think Meg's alluded to this, and I think the fact that we're talking about the fact that there's a bit of a moment for these retellings does draw attention to the fact that it is quite hot right now in publishing. I mean, one of my favourite, like, fairly obscure retellings that's come out in recent years is the life of the English anchorite nun Julian of Norwich, which is called I Julian.
Lads.
So this is I Julian, and it's a sort of a fictional biography of her life as, you know, somebody who received some pretty arousing revelations from Jesus Christ himself.
What a pitch! I'm already sold.
Yeah, Julian of Norwich. Honestly, I'd recommend anyone to read Julian of Norwich. Like, she has some pretty sexy visions of our Lord and Saviour. I think licking the blood from his face or something like that.
Saltburn energy.
Yeah. But no, Julian of Norwich is actually my number one name for a future cat that I might have.
Oh. No. I would love to
name a cat Julian of Norwich.
It is quite a funny name. I do, because Norwich is obviously just Norwich, you know.
Norwich.
And
also, I Julian is a sort of a classical reference, I suppose, via I Claudius,
yeah.
Which is
yeah.
A,
yeah. Definitely. I Julian. Yeah, I like the sound of it.
Okay. Well, from cats to sponges to bubble wrap sex, we've discussed it all in today's episode of Against the Law. But it's time now to assess, I think, what are we most likely to engage with based on these pitches today? I'm going to go first because I call dibs. I think I'm most swayed by Meg's first pitch about the M. Night Shyamalan twist. What was that? Can you remind us of the literature, Meg?
Yes, so that was Achilles. It's just called Achilles, and it was by Elizabeth Cook, and it came out in 2001. Great book.
Okay. All right. So I think I'm most swayed by Achilles, but I would have really liked to be exposed to Xenia's and Barney's self-written stuff as well. So Meg, I'm going to go with you next. What are you most swung by? And you can't have SpongeBob, unfortunately.
Oh. Well, I was quite taken by Sexy Scrub Daddy, but I mean, Sexy Scrub Daddy and Zeus Behaving Badly, I feel like that's a match made in heaven. But we'll leave that behind. I'm not joking. I liked, Barney made a joke at the beginning about is the twist that it's set in space. And I've not been able to stop thinking about it. Space Iliad.
So to be clear, your favourite retelling is one that does not yet exist.
Yeah, Space Iliad. I think it'd be good. I might write it.
Okay. Yeah, do it. Do it quickly, though, because the writers of Doctor Who might get in before you. That sounds like an episode of Doctor Who waiting to be written.
I think there is a classic one where they go to ancient Greece, but don't quote me on that.
Okay, in that case, Space Iliad was the joke suggestion from Barney that won Meg's heart. Barney, what is your favourite retelling from today?
Whilst Xenia put her TV pilot in its sort of social context, I do quite like that thought of like updating the Greek myths and placing them in a modern distribution company. and really, I think genuinely, like, it kind of anticipates a lot of what happens in the Percy Jackson novels, which I think is something that we're going to talk about in our episode on maybe children's book, mm-hmm. children's literature and the ancient world. And so for that reason, that will be my most interested to read option from today's episode. And Godspeed, Xenia, in recovering those files from whatever sort of hard drive hell they're in.
Wow.
Lovely. Xenia, I know some IT specialists, so just hit us up if you need help.
Goodness me, I was not expecting this.
Xenia, while you have time before you go and embark on a USB/hard drive hunting adventure, could you tell us your favourite retelling from today?
I'm afraid I'm going to be a bit of a copycat and go for Song of Achilles, Meg? Or is that a different one?
That's a different one. That's Madeline Miller as well. Just Achilles. I mean, that's also a good book, but I think Achilles is better. Nice. That's my controversial hot take.
Achilles Alone. That is what I'd like to read, given that it comes from such a strong recommendation, which I think is the only strong recommendation from today, isn't it? We were all quite critical of the others.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we've been quite critical of the genre even, which is maybe harsh from us.
Yeah, given how popular it is, maybe it's a bit short-sighted of us.
I don't know. I think we were all fond of Moulin Rouge, weren't we?
Mm. one thing that we didn't discuss is sort of the audience for these things, right? And I think people who are familiar with the sources for these texts are, you know, privileged enough to sort of understand the original texts. And I think the reason why these are so popular is because, you know, they are brilliant stories that are being brought to a new audience. So I don't think we should knock retellings on the basis of being retellings alone. I think they're a brilliant gateway for people. I think that's what Stephen Fry and Neil Gaiman's retellings are so good at, is getting people more interested in the original text. And I think the novels probably serve a similar function.
Totally. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think also it's important to say, like, you can critique things, but also think they should exist and that they are a net good. So yeah, totally agree, Bonnie.
So you heard it from us, folks. Achilles by Elizabeth Cook, published in 2001. That is our biggest recommendation from today. Barney's going to go out and adopt a cat and call it Julian of Norris. Meg is going to invest in scrub daddies, and Xenia's got to go dig through a hard drive. I'm off now to do the washing up and regret everything that I've said about SpongeBob SquarePants. Have a fantastic day, and we'll see you next time on the next episode of Against the Law. If you've enjoyed today's episode, you can always choose to support us on Patreon.
We've got all sorts of tiers for every budget, starting from just £3 a month. Benefits include getting each episode a day early, stickers, and your name in cuneiform.
You can find us on Twitter at Against Law, and you can also find us on TikTok at Against the Law Podcast.
We're also always happy to hear suggestions, questions about the podcast, and other requests. If you want to email us, our email is againstthelawpodcast@gmail.com.